Hello and welcome to another episode of The Bike Shed. Today I am joined by, oh no, I want to say my name. I forget to say my name sometimes. Hello and welcome to another episode of The Bike Shed. I'm your host, Chris Toomey, and I'm joined today by Ben Ornstein, former Thoughtbotter, former host of a Thoughtbot podcast, The Giant Robots Smashing Into Other Giant Robots. And now, well, what are you up to, Ben?
Oh, you know, I'm just here and there doing some things.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
It's great to be back in the studio.
Yeah, you missed this place, I imagine.
Yeah, like the fancy foam on the walls. It's like, it's nice to be in like a professional grade situation. Because I'm just recording from home these days.
Right. I forgot that you also host a podcast. Art of Product is the podcast.
Product, yeah.
Yes. Which has been going for a good bit now as well.
Yeah. We're somewhere like 70 episodes or something like that.
All right, so a little over a year.
Yeah. It's been
nice.
A little while.
Fun.
Yeah.
Pressingly, what is your current focus these days?
Yeah, I won't dodge it this time. It's a fair question. So right now, I am the co-founder of a company called Tuple. And so Tuple was a thing that we decided to start when we looked around and couldn't find a good remote pair programming app.
Mm.
So we were fans of Screen Hero back in the day, loved that. Unfortunately, they were purchased by Slack and then basically shut down without a good alternative. And so I one day was just like looking around and asking around and trying to find people who had some sort of good alternative to it and couldn't find one. And I was like, this does kind of seem like a business opportunity is smacking me in the face.
Mm-hmm.
And I would feel kind of dumb if I didn't at least take a shot at this.
Makes sense. So you've been building now for a while.
Yeah.
This is one of those things you do kind of have to build. Like in general, the recommendation is try to build as little as possible beforehand, but this is a hard one to build too little.
It totally is. Like this, and this has like been a challenge for me from like the MVP point of view, where it's like, it's not a CRUD app where I can like build a quick prototype and then like get it in front of users. Because a core part of the value proposition or the thing that makes it kind of lovable and good is that it's fast. So there's other things out there that do screen sharing, and there are other things out there, though fewer, that do remote control. But we want to do screen sharing plus really good remote control plus low latency. And so just shipping a really slow version with not very good control would be kind of, it'd be like, okay, yeah, people think it's okay. They really want it to be faster and have better things. And so I know I'm falling into that classic trap, you know, like it's so funny, like as soon as I went from like, so I used to do consulting here and I had seen other, you know, founders and CEOs being like, no, it has to be amazing because otherwise this. And like now here I am on the other side of the table, quite literally. And it feels very different. So I'm trying to balance these things where it's like, I know this is the classic trap, but also there's a bit more of a slog to get.
But this time.
This time it's totally
for
different.
For me.
I'm not making the mistake.
As an outside observer
and
someone who has listened to a lot of podcasts in the space and things that talk about this, I think you, well, at a minimum, there isn't a lower minimum, like a low minimum for this is my guess.
Mm.
I don't know actually how much you've built. So it's unclear to me whether like, oh, huh, you have a whole admin. Maybe I wouldn't have done that kind of thing. Those are the questions that I still see. But the like core feature set that you're describing is a difficult one to build.
It is. Yeah.
Like, it's the sort of thing that, to be honest, I have no idea what like, what sort of tubes did you use there,
Ben? You would not believe. So also, by the way, like this would be such an interesting conversation a couple weeks from now because we're launching our like first version next week to our, we have some alpha customers. And so I suspect like everyone else, I will discover the things I thought were the problems are not the problems and everyone's telling us different stuff. So, you know, grains of salt and all that. But like the version that is launching is actually the third version of this that we built.
So the third version of like the tech stack architecture, et cetera.
Exactly. And so we started back in May. So it actually hasn't been that long. It's been about 7 months, which some people think it's fast. So like we started off with just like a, okay, what's the, can we do this prototype? Which is like, okay, we're going to use an Electron app and we're going to write it in JavaScript because we get a whole bunch of stuff for free. Hooray.
That, man, you went strong on the MVP end of the pendulum swing.
Uh-huh.
And then you switched to.
I would call that like not even an MVP. Like we just, it was just like a proof of concept for us.
Right.
So the tech stack we use, like the underlying dependency is WebRTC,
which
is like, oh, it's real-time communications done for you. Kind of.
Right.
Not really. Like it's actually quite a beast. And so the first thing was just like, how do we like start getting our heads around how WebRTC works and how all this stuff fits together? So the first thing was kind of a, let's just learn the space a little bit. The conclusion was pretty quickly like, we can't claim to be about speed and then wrap this thing in an Electron app. Like, it's just never going to be as fast as we want it to be. And so the version two was a Swift app where it's like, okay, let's drop down to a much lower level thing. This is going to be Mac only for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Let's write it in Swift with WebRTC as a dependency. That helped a lot. It gave us more control that we needed. It was faster. But the app is basically is WebRTC. Like, it's our dependency is like a huge piece of the app, and we needed we're constantly having to do bridging between Swift and C++, which is what WebRTC is written in.
Oh, interesting. I would have assumed you had to bring in a JavaScript runtime or a browser environment or a Chromium or something like that.
No.
But it's separated out enough that you were able to get at it.
It is,
which is good, because you would have paid a heavy overhead for all of those other layers that I just listed.
Right, exactly. Like, why not just make it an Electron app if you have to bring in a browser anyway?
Yeah.
So. And so, like, we were bridging through, there is, like, this SDK for using WebRTC on the Mac, but it was, like, there was an intermediary, and the kind of control that we want and the details that we want to sweat, we just kept feeling this, like, impedance mismatch, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And we're like, okay, I think we just got to go all the way and write this thing in, like, C++ at the core.
What is this thing now when you say that? Like, you're still using WebRTC, right?
We are, yeah.
Which... Actually, can we go back and describe a little bit more what WebRTC is and who makes WebRTC and what is it?
So first a caveat, which is I am now the out-of-the-loop CEO. So like, I'm going to do my best here, but some of this may be a little bit wrong. So as far as I can tell, Google makes WebRTC.
Like, okay.
They seem to host it and work on it the most. I think it's just their thing, and it's open sourced for
and
the
world.
And then
Firefox may also bundle that into their
browser runtime. I believe that's how it's done.
Okay.
Yeah. And like, that's how, like, when it shows up in Chrome, it's already been, like, compiled in a certain way and wrapped in certain things, so you have a nice JavaScript interface to it. So if you just wanted to, like, make a thing that shares a screen in two browsers, that's pretty easy, and there's JavaScript APIs for that. If you wanted to run it on the desktop, that's when you enter the world of sadness that we live in right now.
Gotcha.
So it handles the, like, how do we connect two peers? How do we punch through a firewall? How do we find an efficient route between two people? How do we update that route when it gets bad?
Punch through a firewall.
Yeah.
Those are, like, words that I haven't thought about since leaving corporate America.
Yeah, NAT traversal. It's like, it's like a thing. So how do you punch through a firewall? How do you connect two peers behind firewalls? It turns out you create a server that both peers connect to. And then the server says, ah, I see your actual external IP over here, client A and client B, and I can figure out how to route between the two of you.
So are you hosting that external server?
No, people make these things. They're called stun servers, and you can just rent them.
I guess a different way to put it, are you covering the cost of an external server?
Yes.
Interesting, because I would have expected with WebRTC, the whole idea is client-to-client.
It's client-to-client eventually.
But you
the
need
server
a server
handles
broker.
The handshake.
Okay.
Yeah. Which is nice because it's actually just a very lightweight thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like you trade a couple kilobytes of data back and forth, which says, like, my screen size is this. I want to talk on this protocol.
So even if there were wild success in the future and Tuple grew like crazy, your server costs are probably going to remain very low.
Fingers crossed. I think so.
That sounds true-ish.
Sounds true-ish.
True enough for now.
Here's one wrinkle is... Some firewalls are more restrictive than others, so it's possible that this particular technique does not work, and you need something called a turn server, which is where you basically have an intermediary that you forward all the data through. So this would be really sad for us because, A, it would be slower, because now there's another thing involved, and B, we'd have to pay the bandwidth costs. So this is a thing we hope to not support.
You have to just say, sorry, it does not work in these conditions.
Yeah, if you get a really nasty firewall.
Do you have a sense of where those conditions exist? Is it like certain companies will have their people behind that kind of firewall?
Hand wavy. Bad firewalls, mean firewalls that are restrictive and nasty.
Right.
Yeah. Not sure. We'll see. Hopefully not very many.
Gotcha.
So like it cuts into your margins, I guess. So, but hopefully we'll have healthy enough ones that we could support that use case. I think out of the gate, we will not. We'll see.
This is definitely turning into more of a giant robots-esque conversation between you and I. But then what do you think for pricing? It might be too early to ask that as well since you are going towards alpha. But
yeah.
I guess a simpler way to put this is this a single-time purchase sort of thing? Mm. Is there a subscription?
Definitely a subscription, for sure. So I'm not going to say too many specific numbers.
Sure.
But I have already sold this to a number of people.
Mm-hmm.
So to prove to myself and to my co-founders that this is a thing worth building, I was like, let me actually try to sell it and sell the dream. And that was pretty successful. So we have about 35 people in our paid alpha group, like people that have actually given us real money. And some of them are like substantial money, like thousands of dollars.
So those are companies that you're saying like you'll pay for a company-wide license. Everyone in your company can now use this as their means of...
So the model right now is per seat.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like how many developers do you want to give access to for this? And the deal is you pay us a certain number of dollars per developer and we're going to give you access throughout the alpha. You get to help shape the product. And then once the alpha is over, you get a year on top of that. So it's effectively annual pricing.
Gotcha. Actually, I can point you to another podcast where a colleague of mine went to tiered pricing. All right, I'm done with that line of conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that all is interesting. The subscription model definitely makes a lot of sense, especially if you will have external hosting costs. There are certain applications that I see where there isn't an extra cost that the company has to pay. There's no like ongoing support on their side. They're like, no, but we would like it if you paid us every month. And I'm like, no.
Yeah.
On principle, but you actually do have things that you need to manage and support and maintain
for
in
sure.
order for the system to work. So that does make sense.
Yeah. And thanks to the beauty of being a desktop app, we now need to support as the operating system gets upgraded every year, which seems to happen now.
You said Mac only to start, plans for other platforms eventually, but
hopefully if we don't die.
Grand dreams.
Yeah, like, I mean, it's if we can't make a good Mac app, then we're never going to make a Windows app. But
right.
if we can make it good enough that we can turn this into like a we can pay our rent business, mm-hmm. then yeah, for sure. Like, well, very likely. It kind of depends. Would I rather have a company that only has to support one platform? Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
So if like we can grow, first of all, if we can not die and then, you know, like not be destitute, that would be cool.
Mm-hmm.
On just Mac, hey, I would love to just have just Mac. My sense is, and the people I see signing up for a mailing list are actually in surprisingly large companies with like dozens to hundreds of developers. And so I think if I said, hey, this only works on Mac, you have 100 developers. Well, if you have 100 developers, I bet a lot of them are on Windows. There's like enough people. There's a magnitude that's like, okay, we can't say 25 people can't use this if we bought it for the whole team.
Yeah.
So some ideas around it. Like one nice thing about WebRTC is it's not that hard to make a client that you can use in the browser to talk to the desktop kind of thing. So it's like, okay, you can use it on your machine and then I can connect to you via a browser. And I can't do remote control anymore, but I can at least watch. So maybe we can find a middle ground.
So a pared down version for, yeah, that makes sense.
My guess is, again, hopefully not dying, we go to probably Windows or maybe Linux next.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. The Linux thing is interesting because I have all these Linux nerds being like, Linux, you should come to Linux. And I'm like, yeah, right. If we tried to charge you $1, you would say, I could just spin up an ngrok tunnel and SSH over this and do teammate and like be really obnoxious. And I could spin up these five tools that have, you know, and just...
There is that classic Hacker News comment when Dropbox was first announced
I feel like I'd be opting into that, you know?
Yeah.
But also, like, maybe that's changed. Like, maybe one day that will shift. And, like, the first companies that actually say, you know what, people that are running Linux have some willingness to pay now.
Yeah.
And so, like, you'll make a ton of money because you're one of the first people to offer a quality tool on that platform.
I mean, I think one of the things you might run into is I think Linux developers are more resistant to proprietary closed source things, which I'm guessing all of this is.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is a real limitation that you might run into that is about that platform that is, I don't know, less personal, I guess we could say. But there are definitely real constraints across the different worlds. But
mm-hmm.
I also don't know. We don't have that many folks. I think there's only 4-ish people, maybe not even that many in ThoughtBot that are using Linux.
Yeah, nobody on Windows, I assume.
Don't believe we have anyone on Windows right now. Those that are on Linux do care deeply about open source, I will say that. And that's
okay.
A big driver of their reason for being there. So it's less about an unwillingness to pay for things. It's more about like, I'll pay for it, but I would also like access to the source code and the ability to, you know, remix and redistribute. Which... I mean, you're working on top of open source, so there's a certain, like, there's a way that I can be convinced that open source is an argument, but also people need to get paid for things, and we have there's a theme going around the internet right now of the difficulty of maintaining open source and open source maintainers getting burned out and projects that are absolutely critical being fundamentally understaffed. But then again, as a contrast, Let's Encrypt is a beautiful example of something that's going incredibly well, and like Red Hat for the longest time was a company that did really well in the open source space, but and got bought by IBM. Don't know what to think about that one. I think it was IBM. But
IBM makes software? They stopped software, right? I thought they were just services now.
But I mean, that's what Red Hat is. Red Hat makes Fedora / whatever the other name for it is. Fedora is the public version of it, I think. Oh. And then Red Hat is maybe the enterprise version that they do the support for. But that, like, they're a services company. And they were the first $1 billion open source company doing services.
Gotcha.
They just happened to give away this Linux thing for free on the side. Their variant of Linux that then Oracle stole and did their own version of.
They make all their money on, like, helping people make their sound card work. Right? Wi-Fi.
I'm trying to bring the level of discourse up, Ben, and you just keep pulling me down.
I didn't promise I was going to help on that.
No.
You didn't recruit me to that cause.
Well, to shift gears a little bit, the business stuff is certainly interesting, but on this here podcast, we tend to focus more on the tech side of things. So we talked a little bit about the technology stack. I don't know if there's more to dig into there, but
there's
also...
There's so much there. It's ridiculous.
What's the other most interesting thing about the technology stack or the difficulties you faced?
I'll give you a representative example of how annoying this is. One crucial feature... is dual mouse cursors. We think this is really important for like full-time dual remote control of a thing. Like you each need your own mouse. Manual mouse handoff is pretty terrible.
Says a person with whom I built a Vim course.
Oh yeah, here's the thing. Like,
but I agree.
I would never be caught dead using a mouse. I got Vim in the terminal and then Vimium in the browser and like LOL at mice. But if I'm making a thing that's not just for me.
Yeah.
Mouse is pretty important. So we're like, okay, how do you do two mouse cursors? There's no non-hacky way to do two mouse cursors because macOS is like, there is one mouse cursor. And you're like, no, there's two. It's like, no, there's not.
Seems like one of those things you might bake in pretty deep
It's
the
like,
whole, yeah.
That assumption is real deep and getting it to act like it's not is tricky.
So you're drawing a weird fake picture of a mouse on the screen and then when a click is fired there, you quickly move the real mouse over to it and it's some nonsense like that?
That's pretty close, yeah. And there's a transparent window involved.
Of course.
To like intercept the clicks and know where you're clicking on the thing. But so like when you do a weird fake mouse, it doesn't feel right because it doesn't have the right acceleration curve anymore.
There's an acceleration curve to mice?
There is.
So as I'm moving from point A to point B, it's smoothing out and...
I don't exactly know how the curve is shaped, but if you have no acceleration on your mouse, it feels weird. Like you're used to a certain acceleration curve that is built into macOS. And if I turn it off, you go, oh,
yeah.
I don't like this.
But I wouldn't even be able to say why, probably, at first. Yeah, it'd be like, my mouse
slow.
Is wrong.
It feels unresponsive. Okay. Like, when you go a long distance, it doesn't shoot a long distance. It's just like, meh. And it goes like a little ways. And you're like, why are you so pokey, little mouse? And it's like, because I got no acceleration. And so, as part of this, like, faking this really convincing, you there are two mice and you both can control them, we have gone and stolen the acceleration curve that is present in macOS and implemented it locally for you. As like a, here you go, now it'll feel good.
Was this a thing that you were able to find some other people on the internet that said like, okay, I needed to know what it was, so here's the numbers, or did you have to do rigorous experimentation to define the control points of that curve?
We found a guy. Like found a guy who knows a little bit about some of those things.
Is this someone you have on your team or someone that like you found on the internet, you wrote him an email?
And, yeah, external okay. consultant.
Gotcha. Reverse engineered or someone who knew from the inside?
Reverse engineered, actually. Okay. So he had this problem in a previous life of his. And we're like, hey, how do we, like this guy knows some stuff about this thing. This has actually been a really kind of duh obvious in retrospect thing, but has been like an interesting realization for me is that, hey, we don't have to build this alone. Like there are times when this feels really overwhelming and it's like, oh my God, like this is such, it's a really complicated thing that we're trying to do. And like, how are we ever going to figure it all out? And the answer is like, we don't have to figure all of it out because there are people that have expertise in various areas. Mm-hmm. So it's like, oh my God, we're like, we're going to rewrite this in C++. What do we do? It's like, find someone that knows C++ really well and get it started. Like, and so we did that. Mm-hmm. And like, how are we going to do this like weird low level mouse stuff where we're like handling like kernel interrupts or some bizarre nonsense? Yeah. Don't even ask that. That part's, I don't
even
know.
Weren't you a web developer?
Yeah, I was. I used to be. I'm not even a this developer now. Now yeah. I watch. Now I'm a cheerleader. I'm like, I'll go market, do some sales. And so I lost my train of thought, but anyway, mice, they're tricky.
There are people out there that you can call on for
That's those, right.
the expertise and the specifics. That all makes sense.
Yeah. So who knows? We might be able to figure out eventually. Like the guy that makes Discourse, Sam Safran, I think is his name. He's like the head developer guy there. Yep. So he tweeted something like, 18 months into making Discord, I used to say...
Discourse.
Thank you. 18 months into making Discourse, I would say, Discourse is good now.
Mm.
3 years later, now I can actually say, no, for real, now Discourse is actually good.
But there's the classic adage of if you're not embarrassed by your first version, then you waited too long.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah. Like, we got to ship. We got to get stuff out there and start learning things. But I do think, like, software takes a while to get good. I think this is something a lot of people don't quite realize or that, like, I wish weren't true, but is true.
Mm.
Where it's like, our first version is, like, not where we want it to be. And I think 6 months from now, we will still be far from where we want to be. And this is, like, a multi-year get really good piece of software. Because there's just so many little details to sweat and so many little things to learn, like acceleration curves. And
things
and like,
that you didn't even know. The unknown unknowns are the tricky ones. Those are the dangerous, the minefields.
Yeah, for sure. Exactly.
And I think you framed it correctly of we need to ship because we need to start learning things. Mm-hmm. Like you can't actually learn in a vacuum. You can. There are certain things that you figured out by using it yourself, but it needs to be in front of real users.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break to tell you about today's sponsor. This episode of The Bike Shed is brought to you by OneMonth.com. Did you know that 50% of the best-paying jobs call for the ability to code? OneMonth.com is the absolute best place to learn how to code in just 1 month. Their courses have helped over 60,000 students go from knowing zero about coding to building programs in languages like Python, Ruby, and JavaScript. OneMonth.com graduates have gone on to get jobs at prestigious startups like Airbnb, Instagram, and Spotify. OneMonth.com's courses are easy to follow with step-by-step video tutorials, instructor-led with weekly assignments reviewed by your instructor, and results-driven, with each student graduating the course with a portfolio of projects to show prospective employers, as well as a certification of completion. Are you interested in taking your career to the next level? For a limited time, head to onemonth.com/thebikeshed to get 10% off any coding course. Again, that's onemonth.com/thebikeshed to get 10% off any coding course. A big thank you to onemonth.com for supporting The Bike Shed and online education. Well, to back things up a little bit, away from the specifics of the technology, there's sort of an overarching vision that you have here, I imagine, around the world needs more remote pair programming.
Totally.
So I'm interested to hear, what is that overarching vision? What is the story of this app or like pair programming in your mind?
Yeah. So pair programming actually was an inflection point in my career. My first programming job where I really learned a lot and felt like my skills got leveled up in a substantial way was I was on a small team. And I paired basically every day for about 6 months with my boss. Mm. This is when I first came into the Ruby world, and I was learning Ruby and Rails at the same time, and Vim. Just like sitting next to this person and absorbing from him every day was like the highest bandwidth learning time I have basically probably ever had in my career. It marked such a turning point. And this is the job I had before Thoughtbot. This is like what like leveled me up to the level that I could get here, mm-hmm. which is another inflection point. So when people are like, how do you improve as a programmer? I'm like, well, the best thing you can possibly do is pair with someone that knows more than you every day until you're at their level. Like everything else is not quite as good as that. And so that's sort of a postulate A, I guess, mm-hmm. theory A. And then theory B is people are going increasingly remote. Like Thoughtbot, I hear, even has some remote-ish people. This is like creeping in.
We do, yes. Yeah. We have Herman, who is currently remote. Right. I think that's it for right now, but okay. Yeah.
So like even a stalwart, we like to work in person kind of company is starting to say like, maybe this makes sense sometimes. And so I think this trend will continue. I think there'll be more developers every year and more of them will be remote. And so if you take those theories and put them together, it's like, well, if you're remote, you're missing out on this pretty awesome pairing thing, which I think is a wonderful tool for learning, but also getting good code shipped mm-hmm. and keeping people happy and feeling connected. I think it might even be more important when you're remote to pair program so that you don't feel like you're totally isolated.
It's an interesting framing that I hadn't thought about, but yeah.
Yeah, so like this is my pitch to development managers, as you would imagine. It's like, if you have these remote people, are you supporting them? Like, mm-hmm. what kind of support are you giving? And this is one way you can support them. So given all those things, I think there's a space for this. There's a need for this that I think will increase with time.
That all makes sense. It's interesting the way you framed it of like the number one thing you can do to get better is pair with someone who's better than you, and mm-hmm. that will pull you up. I would then put onto the list as the second best thing you can do is pair with someone who's more junior than mm-hmm. you are, newer to the field. And I'm always surprised by how much pressure that puts on my thinking. And like, I know a thing well enough to hack it together, but when I need to know it well enough to explain it to another person, yeah. suddenly like the holes in the ship are very clear and the discrepancies in my knowledge, or it just forces me to like, actually, you know what? Let's go look that up. Wow, I was totally wrong about that. And it's incredibly valuable, basically any skill combination.
Totally agree.
Pairing, which is interesting.
Yeah, I challenge you to pair with anyone for an hour and not learn something. It mm-hmm. doesn't matter if they are newer or more experienced than you, I think.
I feel like I could see a time where one person might not learn something, but there's always an exchange of information, mm-hmm. I would say. And it's rare that both won't come out with something new, mm-hmm. especially if you haven't paired with that person before. Like there are people that I've gotten into a rhythm with where most days we're kind of just going along. And I think we're still better together because mm-hmm. I think pairing, it focuses people in a way. It keeps things like, I tend to make more checklists when I'm pairing with someone to mm-hmm. just enumerate out loud, here's what I'm thinking of the next steps, but let's together agree whether or not we think that's the right set of next steps.
Yep.
I don't do that as much on my own because it's just in the back of my head. But sometimes when I'm feeling a little bit more unclear about the work, I will actually go almost into pairing mode and say like, oh, I should do that thing that I do when I'm pairing and make a little checklist and then talk to myself as if I'm a pair and mm-hmm. explain to me what I'm going to do in the next few minutes.
Yeah, like rubber ducking yourself.
Indeed.
I think the cool thing about pairing is that it raises the bar on like what kind of communication level you need to have. Mm-hmm. If you're going to do it well, it makes you communicate more, which I think tends to lead to better decisions and processes. If you're forced to kind of say out loud what you think is next, it makes you think about what's next as opposed to kind of just like blindly moving forward in a linear way.
Yeah. I think people do TDD and other things like that more when they're pairing. Mm. Like there's a certain mm-hmm. pressure from like a psychological perspective, but there's also, if you have to say out loud what you're going to do, then you're often like that's already pushing you towards a thinking upfront sort of mindset. And then TDD naturally blends with that. Mm. But I've noticed that with folks where I'm like, I can tell that we weren't doing TDD otherwise, but now when you're pairing, you are. And I think it's beneficial because it does sort of slow things down, but in a purposeful way, in a go slow to go fast or slow down to speed up, those sort of adages of mm-hmm. slow is Oh, what is it?
Slow is smooth and smooth is fast or something?
I think it's that one, yeah. Something like that. There are a bunch of these, but they all speak to the same idea of it. Like more methodical, more purposeful, more focused. Mm-hmm. And those are all definitely benefits that I feel when I pair. I'm actually pairing right now before and after this podcast. And
nice.
It's fantastic.
This is almost like a pair podcast.
This is indeed.
That's a nice point, which is like there's a number of factors that I think increase the quality of the code that comes out of a pair. And like one of them you touched on, which is like there's that subtle social pressure. So even just by having someone sitting next to you writing the code, you're probably less likely to cut corners or to ship something that you know is like, we're gonna have to come back and fix this up later. And that's like even before you ask yourself, like, is my pair helping me write better code? Like just them sitting there helps you.
Yep.
And then like you also have access to their whole brain, and then they're like, hey, maybe we should write a test first.
Mm-hmm.
Or what do you think about maybe extracting this or something? And then that's part of the reason I think it's worth pairing with someone, even if they're like more junior than you, is because the fact that they're sitting there means you're probably going to write it better.
I'm interested what you've seen of, now that you're talking to more development managers, specifically about the topic of pairing.
Mm.
I've not necessarily run into this myself, but I've heard of resistance of like, well, why would I pay two people to do one person's job?
Mm-hmm.
That sort of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Have you run into that at all? Have you like? It sounds like your conversations are at a different level, but have you run into that specific line of thinking?
I have run into that. Not so much with the people that I'm talking to from like a sales or marketing perspective, because they're already generally bought in if they're interested at all in a tool like this. Like if you don't believe in pairing, you probably don't want a remote pairing tool. But I do run into this argument on Twitter. Someone just like straight up baited me the other day. It's like, how could you possibly do this? So I've been writing like a pairing guide that I've attempted to answer this question a couple different ways, but I'll ad lib it here, which is kind of, you're right that you're paying two people to accomplish the same thing. If you are like an assembly line worker making widgets, that makes sense. Like if it's a discrete process where it's easy to know what to do and people don't ever get stuck, then yeah, it's pretty clear that like having two people do the same thing is probably not worthwhile. But programming is so different than that, where like the quality of the code that you write matters a lot, because it's going to either help you go faster or go slower later. And basically every project slows down over time. So like people basically always ship slower the more code that there is. And you can kind of mitigate that by writing really good code. And so I think one of the fundamental imperatives of a dev team is, once you're a little bit mature and you're not just like trying to scrape together an MVP, is like, how do we write this in a high quality way so that we don't slow down later? And I think pairing is a really nice answer to that. Two sets of eyes on a thing help ensure that the code that goes out has fewer bugs and is better quality.
The other thing that I would strongly highlight is the lack of siloing of information.
Yeah.
There are plenty of teams that I come into where it's, oh, well, John Q, that developer, he's the one who handles the billing system.
Mm-hmm.
And this person handles the UI and the front end and the widgets. And it's like, right, but now what if they're on vacation, or what if, et cetera, plenty of things that can cause that. Or just now no one can review the PRs. No one knows that system well enough to give meaningful feedback. And pairing, again, just allows for two people to have had, to have loaded all of the context of whatever subsystem they're working on into their heads and be able to recall that when it's necessary down the road, which it inevitably will be.
Right. It also makes them better at reviewing it. It's like if you and I pair on something and then a month later you're like, hey, I have a PR on that stuff. I'm up to speed in a way that I wouldn't be otherwise. I can give a better review of your work.
Yep. I'll say though, for as much of a fan of pairing as I am, and you obviously are, I've never gotten to the point of doing like 100% pairing or even 50%.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that is because it's truly exhausting.
Yeah.
You come to the end of the day, and because you're on 100%, you're even, I'm guessing like it's a little bit more than my normal, like I can do potentially 8 clock hours of development, but not 8 hours, maybe, I don't know.
Yeah.
But pairing just takes it out of you in a way that is different. And as a result, I've never gone that far in the extreme, but like we're speaking of it in such high terms. So do you have a sense, or do you have a thought on like an ideal ratio, or?
I don't, except that it's almost definitely not 100%.
Mm-hmm.
Like that sounds way too high to
almost
me as well.
Almost nothing exists at those
exactly.
sort of extremes. Zero is certainly wrong.
Yeah.
100 is definitely, well, feel less strong, but strong that 100 is wrong.
I wouldn't go so far as to call it wrong for sure. Like Pivotal pairs all the time and it seems to work for them. They make a heck of a lot more money than my company. So, hey, I don't know. There's all these arguments in programming in particular, and maybe this is true of other fields, where you're like, X is a good practice. And people are like, yeah, but if you did X all the time, these bad things would happen. It's like, okay, yes, I get it. It's not like, just be like, this thing is good, but let's neither overprescribe it nor underprescribe it.
Mm-hmm.
This is why we get paid the big bucks. It's because the right answer is subtle and changes and is context dependent. And so sometimes it makes sense to spend a few hours during your day pairing on something with somebody, and it matters who you pair with. And some days it's you should just go do it yourself.
Yeah. There are basically two catchphrases of this podcast. One is, I have strong feelings about that. And the other is, it depends. Those are the two. And it's weird because it's a podcast about development, which seems like it should be a straightforward thing. And yet here's all
LOL
this subtlety.
Yeah. So I got successfully baited into that Twitter argument with somebody about like, how could pairing possibly make any sense? And I replied a little bit. And like I gave my argument kind of like, it's not like we're making widgets. Like, it's more subtle than that. Here's some, like, read this link. I wrote up a whatever essay on this. And he said something like, the point where I disengaged was, programming is actually very simple, was one of his sentences. And I just responded, I was like, LOL at that. And then I was like, I'm done here.
Yeah.
Programming is actually very simple. Yeah, exactly. Totally. It's totally figured out.
We've got it. All of
this
the applications
guy, you should
work.
Google that phrase and find this person and reach out to him because he's figured out programming and it's actually very simple.
Again, I'm trying to raise the level of the discourse, so I'm not going to actively seek out a person.
Don't mob this person.
No, certainly not that. It is interesting to me how someone could have that view, though, legitimately. Like, you've done this thing and you come out of it saying, like, we got this.
Yes. So I've been trying to do this thing. I saw that I get all my knowledge through Twitter these days.
Sure.
And someone was like, when you see a viewpoint that you think is crazy, try to make yourself imagine a world where you would have that viewpoint too. And I was able to empathize with this a little bit because I felt this way just over the beginner hump of various things I've started doing. So like in the beginning, when I first start trying to learn like rock climbing, everything is very confusing. It's like, this is so hard. It doesn't make any sense. It's really difficult. And then you kind of get the basics under your belt and you start improving really fast. And you're like, actually, rock climbing is very simple. Just use your legs instead of your arms. They're way stronger. And then you bump up into the like, oh, actually, there's much more here that I don't know. Yep. And so I think most likely that person is in kind of that phase of learning about programming where he's got the basics kind of under his belt and he's not aware of this deep ocean of unknowns yet.
Yeah, that seems plausible. The coming back to unknowns, that's like when you start to see a few of them and you're like, oh, I didn't know that was there.
Right.
But it is there. What other things are there that I don't know are there?
Yeah.
And when you get a sense that actually there's a lot of stuff that exists in that space, then you come away with like, this is not simple.
Yes. And in complete fairness, when I go back and I read my oldest blog posts, I inevitably cringe at the confidence with which I proclaim things. It's always embarrassing. Like a blog post is more than a few years old. I'm like, oh my God. Like I just see this like brash confidence that I'm like, you did not deserve this confidence. You were totally right. Like, and often I just completely disagree with this point that I was so sure of. So I can empathize with this person. Perhaps he will look back on this tweet and say, maybe not.
Perhaps. Yeah. But broadly, this whole programming game is complicated. Pair programming does seem to be a way to mitigate some of it.
Yeah.
I think
it's
the best
tool
one
for
that
the
I've
toolbox.
Found. Yeah.
Like, build up a good toolbox of good approaches and good tools and use them where they are best.
So in the sense of this being a tool in toolboxes, there are some different ways to go about pair programming. And one question I have is, are you going to build any pairing-specific features into the app? The one that comes to mind immediately, and I hope your answer is no, because you shouldn't build this extra thing until you've built the first thing. But often there's the idea of ping-pong pairing, of like, I'm driving your... I don't know what the word for the other
navigating.
Person is. Navigating, yeah. So one person's hands on keyboard and or mouse, if you're going that way, and they're doing the typing. The other person is only speaking, saying like, oh, can we extract that method? Let's go build the class now. Let's, you know, whatever is the next step in the programming, but they're not actually touching the keyboard. So my understanding is the application that you're building allows for bidirectional control. Either person can control at any point. But would it be useful to have a more purposeful, like driver A is in control now, now it's switching over to driver B and a more explicit handing back and forth?
We do actually have two modes right now, which is there's navigator mode where it's my mouse clicks don't affect your screen. Like if I click, it just sort of gives you a little indication, like it's like a pointer almost, like a, hey, look at this spot of the screen or look at this line over here. And my keyboard commands stay local so that I can easily command tab over to like a browser and check some documentation or whatever. Then co-pilot mode, where my keyboard commands fall through to your machine and also my mouse clicks. So we do support sort of two ways of operating that way. We also do have, as far as pair programming specific features, we do have one thing that has come up so far, which is if I, as a navigator, am looking at an interesting Stack Overflow post or something and I want to share it with you, we have a little dot box I can drop that URL in and it will detect automatically on your side that I've sent you a URL and open up your browser.
Oh, that's
nice. So like, it's like, hey, check this out. And then boom, we're looking at the same thing. But that's it for now. I think eventually more features will sprout as people use it in the real world. And we use it too and say, hey, it would be nice if we could X, Y, Z. But that's about it these days.
Again, I don't necessarily know that it would even make sense to build into the product specific things. But I'm always intrigued by sort of the mechanics of pairing.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I'll go to clients and they're not as familiar with it. And they're like, what do you even mean by that, though? What does pairing mean?
Mm-hmm.
And the simplest answer is just two people looking at the same code working together. But then there are more subtle versions of it, like the idea of that ping pong or the driver and navigator. That's an explicit mode in which you can do it. TDD trading off. So I write the failing test and then you get to implement it, which always ends up in shenanigans in my experience of like, okay, you want the test to return the number two. Congratulations. This function now returns the number two. I have implemented the code. And then there's almost an antagonistic pairing mode that gets into. But I don't know. There are other ways that people pair. What's good pairing?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know quite where I come down yet a little bit. So the people that pair the most seem to recommend changing drivers a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So they recommend split it up, driver, navigator. One person's hands on keyboard, the other person is mostly just watching and thinking. And the navigator is thinking high level things, making task lists, making that checklist that you tend to do, and thinking about the next thing coming down the road, spotting bugs, typos, things like that. But swapping frequently seems to be the most recommended practice. Because it's easy to tune out when you're the navigator a little bit. And that, like, pairing while someone else checks their phone, or like programming while someone else checks their phone, or like is looking at Twitter, or is like kind of zoned out thinking about other stuff, that's not really pairing. That's something else.
I've seen plenty of cases where, like, say I'm introducing a colleague at Thoughtbot to a new language. So I'm definitely more senior in terms of knowledge of that language, or vice versa. They may be introducing me, but whoever's got that more knowledge will often lead and be the driver for the first little bit. But I think it's critically important when you have that transition point and say, okay, you've seen enough. It's going to be awkward, but here's the keyboard. It's time to dive in. And like, it is absolutely critical to have that transition and get the keyboard into the other person's hands.
Yes.
I often, when I'm working with people, talk about like, okay, you've got it in your head. Now you need to get it into your hands. Talking about like what's the word for the idea of having like mechanical memory, muscle memory, but not specifically that. The idea of like, I have typed it. I have moved the code around is different than just seeing or reading the code or watching it.
For sure.
And I don't know if there's actually like a physio-mechanical thing going on there.
Yeah. I mean, that's astute observation that's important. You can watch someone write Haskell for like a week and then you're like, all right, let me try. How do I make a function?
I didn't actually learn anything.
How do I return? Like, it's like you get it when someone else is leading the way. Like the difference between following what someone else is doing and then creating your own thing is so different.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I've run into this myself with like other languages. Like I listen to a lot of podcasts in Spanish and my listening gets way ahead of my speaking. And then as soon as I try to talk to somebody, I'm like, it's hard, time, words, things. It's like, oh yeah, those are discrete skills. Just because it can come in doesn't mean it can go out.
Yep. Pair programming.
Yeah. You know, it's a thing.
It is. It's a thing. I like, much like TDD, it's not the only way to do things, but it is 100%. A practice. It's a practice that I think has proven itself out, both pair programming and TDD.
Hmm.
They both apply interesting constraints. They force breaking things down into smaller pieces, communicating more, stating things out loud or in TDD in tests.
Mm-hmm.
There's a parallel between the two of them that I find really interesting.
Mm-hmm. So I did an article on our pair programming guide about the scientific research into pairing, and there's not very much of it. And the stuff that's out there is unfortunately what you might expect, which is like on college students, because that's who's available for studies like this. But there has been some interesting like surveys, attempts to do like rigorous surveys of people who do pairing. And one of the results that has been found fairly consistently is that people that pair report liking it and like being happier at their jobs. And so it's like this thing where it sounds kind of difficult, and it kind of is. It's like a lot to ask, and it's like there's some social pressure there. But people that get into the swing of it and get comfortable with it seem to dig it and also like feel more connected to their colleagues and like more engaged with their job.
Basically, as a rule, my goal on Fridays is to pair with someone from Thoughtbot.
Nice.
Especially because we end up, you know, siloed on a project with one or two other developers or designers, but we're not working with the rest of the team that we have here. So it's a way for me to have that. And it is definitely like, I'm happier on days that I'm pairing.
Yeah. Have you noticed commonalities between like sessions that go better than others?
Not necessarily. Some of that has to do with the problem, I would say. Like, we tried a weird, hard thing that didn't actually work out today. But even then, I still enjoy the process more when it's with someone else.
Mm.
In fact, that is one of the things that is most pronounced for me with pairing is if I'm developing on my own, especially like in the morning, that's my best brain. That's the one that's going to be able to do the best work. In the afternoon, if I hit a wall, suddenly the thing that I thought was going to work doesn't work. And I'm like, okay, I need to now rethink, reorganize all of my thoughts around this. I will perhaps get distracted, perhaps go for a walk, get a coffee, something else much more readily if I'm working on my own. But when I hit that wall with a pair, I often will just verbalize. I'm like, huh, okay, we hit this thing. I don't know what to do. Do you have any thoughts? Mm-hmm. And often that person can step in and they're a little bit fresher because they haven't necessarily been like holding on to as much of the thinking at that point. And they're like, oh, well, we could try this. And it keeps the momentum going.
Yes.
Which is part of why it's so exhausting, because like there isn't that downtime, but I don't necessarily want that downtime actually. Like, I'm happy to have put in a nice full day, get at the end and be like, I'm spent. Time to go home. I feel good.
Yeah.
I left it all on the dance floor, as they say.
Yeah. I think that's maybe one of my favorite things about pairing, is that it's harder to get blocked. Mm-hmm. Like, the least fun part of programming is like, this doesn't work. I have no idea why. And like, everything I try is not working. It's so frustrating. And like, that's not like leaving on the dance floor. That's just like struggling near the dance floor. Where it's like, the best thing to me is a day where we just make consistent progress hour by hour. Like, the thing just keeps getting closer to completion. And when you have two people, it's just, it's harder to get blocked. And that's so like, you tend to keep moving, which tends to keep the energy high.
Yep. I also noticed that my like Git hygiene and things like that tend to be a little bit better. Mm-hmm. I say the phrase, you know what, we should commit. We should just, like, that's a meaningful point that we just got to. I say that even more with a pair and checking in and pushing work up and things like that, because now I'm working with someone else. So I should definitely push this branch up just in case they want to run with it after, like, when I go record a podcast or something.
Yeah. You're a development director now? Is that true?
I am, yes.
Yeah, so, like, I imagine you feel, like, some social pressure there, too, where it's, like, you want to set a good example as you're pairing with someone. So is that subtle, like, how does Chris do this when he's working? And like, well, I want to make sure I'm doing the right things.
People just ask me about Vim things.
Yeah, I bet.
There's a lot of Vim. I try
to
downplay
a lot of
Vim.
How did you do that?
There is. And I both am like, oh, yeah, no, that's, nope, nope. Now's not the time. Let's write it on a list. We'll come back to it on Friday or talk about it another time.
But yeah. Are you still nerding out hard? Are you like, are you still leveling up your Vim these days?
Not as much, I would say. I reached a happy point, I would say. Like, there's a lot of Tmux and FCF and Vim, and they all go together real well.
What's
and
FCF? I don't even know.
FCF is the generic fuzzy finder.
Okay.
So, like, control P within Vim was the fuzzy find files, but I forget how it even... It was Vim script, which is a bad language. Uh-huh. FCF is written in Go, and it's a command line utility that has a Vim wrapper, but it also just runs at the command line. So I can ls and pipe to FCF, and now I have a fuzzy list of files, or I can Tmux list sessions, and I have a fuzzy list of sessions. Basically, everything in the world is now fuzzy, which is what I want.
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah.
Do you keep a lot of Tmux sessions around?
I do. Basically, every Git repository maps to a session in my world.
Wowzers.
And then every, well, I don't have them all open, but any that I'm working on, and I don't restart my computer unless I have to.
Sure.
So I'll often have, like, my dot files is open in one, blog post I'm writing is open in another. I have Upcase in the background, perhaps, if I'm working on that. I have Client App 1, Client App 2, because it's
often, and then you have, like, multiple, what do they call it, windows or something? And then you have, like, it's like you have an editor plus a terminal plus the running server plus something else going on in each, like, individual session?
Yeah, so, like, a Tmux session for a Rails app will have, in the first Tmux window, it'll be Vim and maybe a REPL next to that. So two splits on that. And then the second window of that Tmux session is running the server, or possibly two servers, because now there's the Rails server and the JavaScript Webpacker nonsense or whatever doing these days. And just keep adding processes, or like a worker process if I need that.
Yeah, it's funny. People still think of me as this Vim person. And like, I think of you as the Vim person, where I'm like, I was like, no, you don't, I don't know anything. You should talk to Chris Toomey.
I don't necessarily want this title. I've earned it. It's for good reason. I've written too much Vim script to be like, I'm not really a Vim person. But
yeah.
I have strong feelings on this matter, which are, I don't think it makes sense to spend as much time optimizing your workflow as I have.
Sure.
If you're trying exclusively to be as efficient as possible.
Yeah.
There is an aspect of enjoyment and hobby to my work in Vim. Like, sometimes on a weekend, I will write some Vim script because I'm just really captured by the idea of, can I solve this problem? It's a puzzle. It's a fun puzzle for me to work on. And I find that I seem to have a higher discomfort when my workflow is not as smooth as possible. Other people are perfectly fine working through things, and I think they should definitely not spend the amount of time that I do, because that's not a great use of your time. But for me, it is. It's an investment in my day-to-day happiness, and it's fun. They're puzzles. They're like, some people do Sudokus. I write Vim script.
Yeah, yeah.
For the record, I recommend Sudokus. It's a much better thought out sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I feel like this is coming off more negative than I want it to. It's, I am purposeful, and I'm very careful during like a work day that that's not the time to be messing around with Vim. And so I've gotten better and better over the years of taking note of things and then having a prioritized backlog, essentially, of the little hacks, the shell scripts and things that I want to write, and picking those up on weekends and things like that when I've got some time. But also, I've sort of settled in. I think I've figured out how to make the terminal into the IDE of my dreams. And VS Code looks fantastic, as an aside. If you're new to programming, don't learn Vim. Learn VS Code.
Wow.
Maybe years later, if you really want to. Vim's fantastic. I love it with all my heart. But start with VS Code. It's an absolutely amazing piece of technology.
Huh. That's cool.
Yeah.
I'm surprised to hear it. Such a strong endorsement.
I mean, it's Vim emulation layer is not good enough for me. I've tried it. Yeah. I wish it would work. It also, like, it integrates a terminal in a way that is in contrast with how I think that sort of stuff should work. I prefer Tmux wrapping these different processes that are all as good as they can be and yada, yada, yada. But if you're new to programming and people are telling you that you need to learn Vim, I strongly disagree with that.
Hmm. Yeah, I agree. For new people.
For new people.
You have enough to learn already.
It's a great way to up your efficiency to think about things a little bit different. I think about editing text very differently and how I interact with code very differently as a result of Vim. It has formed my thinking the same way that, like, working with Haskell changed my thinking about code. But I wouldn't necessarily recommend Haskell to everyone, especially not as their first language. Although I actually hear people do well with that, but... So that was a fun diatribe.
Yeah. Do you have any fun, like, Vim stuff you want to share? Just, like, cool stuff you are toying with or have implemented?
I gave a talk at Boston React Conference back in September, and 50% of the feedback from it was, oh, interesting talk about React and GraphQL. And fully 50% of the feedback was, you did some weird stuff in Vim. What was that?
Yeah.
I keep meaning to actually package it up and share it with the world.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
But that's definitely the intention. But part of the earlier conversation about the burden of open source.
Yeah.
I don't want to put this thing out there with a half-baked interface and then have to support that. I have one plugin that a bunch of people use, and I still, like, once a week, I get people writing in issues, and some of them are fine, and they're like, oh, I found a real thing, and I'm like, oh, I will fix that. But some of them are like, you didn't read the README. But I'm going to help you out because I can tell that you haven't opened a lot of issues on GitHub, and I don't want to be mean to you in this. I don't want to be that person for you on the internet. But there's a surprising number of issues that I've responded to on a simple plugin that integrates Tmux and Vim.
Yeah.
So I'm much more conservative in what I put out into the open source world. So it's, I definitely plan to, but
it's a loss for the world.
This is, again, that, like, the burnout and whatnot of open source maintainers. I have a tiny little bit of open source out there, and I still, I know that feeling.
Okay, well, you can just tell me. I won't share with anyone.
I mean, I might also just be like, I've said this enough times at one point. Here you go. No support.
Yeah. Well, like, what about, I feel like I've seen you use some text objects that I'm not familiar with, that, like, maybe you invented or something.
I do. I have a whole talk about that. Mastering the Vim language, which is on the ThoughtBot YouTube channel. I'm proud of that one. I think that talk at this point was like 3 years ago, but it still represents what I think about Vim. Like, why I think Vim matters is captured in that talk, and my thinking hasn't really evolved from that. Perfect. Which is part of why I say, like, I haven't actually been messing with it as much. I think I built towards the content of that talk, and then, cool, I think I said it. I think that's what I mean.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm happy. I'm relaxed in my old age.
Yeah. It's funny how it mellows you out a little bit.
Yeah.
I think people sometimes want me to fight with them about certain things, about like how good Vim is, or whether you should do TDD, or whether pairing is a good idea. And I'm just kind of like, I'm not really into this anymore. Like, I'm not into fighting about this.
Yes. It depends. There's subtlety. There's the interesting one of code formatters. Which is like the fights that happen of like, well, yeah, I mean, code formatters are good, but I don't like that format.
Sure.
It's like, oh, I think we're missing the point, though. The whole point is to not have the discussion about the format.
Yeah, for sure.
But that becomes an interesting one of like, I don't even want to fight that fight.
Yeah. I think I've just lost the certainty of youth a little bit.
Ooh, yeah, I mean, you were describing that of your earlier blog posts.
Yeah, I think I've been bitten by that enough times to know, like, actually, I bet 5 years from now I'll feel a little bit differently. So maybe I shouldn't be so strong in my pronouncements.
Yeah. Well, on that note, I think that is a perfect way to wrap up this whole podcast. Thank you so much for joining us, Ben.
It was fun. I liked
it. And where can folks find you on the internet if they want to keep up with what you're up to?
I'm R00K on Twitter if you want to try to bait me into some arguments about whatever, futilely, hopefully. Also, if you want to check out Tuple, it's tuple.app, although we also put in an application for tuple.dev, which is apparently coming around.
How do you spell Tuple?
T-U-P-L-E.
Okay.
I hate that you had to ask that.
Yep.
So, like,
I know, but not...
I know. It's so frustrating because, like, the first name we thought of within, like, 1 minute was Tuple. And then we spent weeks trying to think of a name we liked as much because we're like, yeah, but it's kind of an, like, people that aren't programmers won't really know what it is. And I'm going to hate having to explain it every time I tell someone who's non-technical, and even some people that are technical will not catch the joke that's kind of in there. And so we tried and tried and tried. And
to be honest, I just now got the joke.
You just got that?
Yeah.
Yeah, see, this is the problem. It's, I don't know.
Naming
it's,
is hard, as
naming
they say.
Naming is hard.
We'll invalidate the cache on the internet, and then you can try again.
The whole internet.
The whole internet.
Just reboot the whole thing.
Just unplug it, plug it back in.
Great strategy.
Awesome. Well, we will have links to all of those things. And again, thank you so much, Ben.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. Show notes for this episode can be found at bikeshed.fm. If you've enjoyed this episode or any of the others, you can leave us a rating or review on iTunes or share it on Twitter. And if you have any feedback for this or any of the other episodes, you can reach us at @_bikeshed, or you can reach me at Chris Toomey on Twitter, or you can email us at hosts@bikeshed.fm. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.
This podcast was brought to you by ThoughtBot. We are experienced designers and developers who turn your idea into the right product. With local studios in Boston, San Francisco, New York, London, Austin, and Raleigh, let's build something great together.